welcome to His Holy Church Q&A, and the topic today is Sacred Purpose Trusts. And trusts are pretty complicated. They're simple in one sense, but they can become very complicated because there's so many different forms of trusts. People expect so much from trusts, and they've been around for such a long time. And so we're going to discuss some of those things, but mostly in relationship to how Christ used a trust to set the captive free, or at least elements of a trust to set the captive free, and how that is similar to the trusts that were being set up by Moses, and even by Jacob, who became known as Israel. And at that time, all the way back to Nimrod and Abraham's father, Terah, they're all setting up elements of a trust. And they may not have used the word trust. Of course, they're speaking other languages. But elements of what we would call a trust today. And after William the Conqueror seized the chattels and choses of Harold by defeating him in trial by combat at Hastings, there were a number of people that were very afraid that they would also have their properties taken and stolen by, you know, William the Conqueror and the men who came over from Normandy. And so they began to set up trusts where they would put their property in a trust to protect it from any unwarranted usurpations, or what they would think is unwarranted usurpations, because there was this extremely powerful king that now had a foothold in parts of Great Britain. And so this is all the way back in 1066. And so there are these trusts in 1066 that are being set up, and they actually were using something calling itself the church to set up these trusts. And, you know, there are things in the Bible about not setting up pledges, etc., that could be overlapping in that, but eventually came out of this effort by a lot of people, because there were two laws going on in England at that time. There was the common law, and then the law that William the Conqueror brought over from Normandy, which was more like the King's Law, and got into the area of what eventually became the Star Chamber courts of the king. Contracts were being made that the remedies that a contract might be in equity, or the remedies of a contract might be at common law, or they might have other remedies altogether different. And this would be spelled out at the bottom of any kind of contract. And there were certain things that you couldn't enforce at common law in 1066, and that you could now enforce in England because they brought this new law over that had not previously had much of a foothold in Great Britain. There were times when they would use this other law, this equity law, this contract law that was outside of the common law. And one of the ways they did it, it's kind of interesting, is they had fairs. Now, we have that word today, fairs. They would actually take an area and mark it off, usually near a sea coast or a harbor, and people could bring goods into that fair area and sell them. And if there was any dispute at the sale or during the process of the sale, they had their own courts within this boundary. And those courts were not necessarily common law courts. They were administrative courts set up by whatever rules those fairs were using. But when the fair was all over, which might last a week, might last a month, probably at the outside, they would take down all the boundaries, all the tents would disappear, all the All the vendors would be gone, all the boats that brought them in and the carts that brought stuff to these places to have these exchanges would all disappear, and it would go back, and supposedly common law was now the law of that land. It was a temporary system that was set up. It wasn't all the time, there were a number of them. It's actually historical things, and the courts were called the pie powder courts, which was an interesting term. Because it's almost like the court of the dusty feet. Because when the fair was over, you had no more recourse on any of the transactions that you made. It's just gone. But there are all kinds of interesting things if you study the history of law and the history of trusts. How far do trusts go back? Of course, we've already said they go all the way back to Terah. They go back to Nimrod. They go back to Abimelech. They go back to Melchizedek. But when we say the word trust today, a lot of times people are thinking statutory trust. And just to give you an example, people talk about that your Social Security payments are in a Social Security trust fund. And that's actually kind of an imaginary idea. There's no real basis in law for it. You hear it all the time in the news. You even hear it sometimes in statutes. But there is no trust fund, because it's been ruled over and over again that there is no separation of funds. If the government's operating in the red, then Social Security is already in the red. It's an imaginary idea that, oh, we still have enough money in Social Security to make all the payments. No such reality exists in the law, and that's clearly ruled over and over again. If you want any money from Social Security, that requires that the government, that has elements of trust in it too, but as a civil corporation, take money from its sources or borrow money from the future, making the citizens more surety to debt. I just shared on X, Catherine Austin Fitz talking about trillions of dollars going missing in just some of the departments of government back in 1997, every year, trillions of dollars would go missing and nobody knew what happened to it. That's over 25 years ago. So she used the figure of $3 trillion. So multiply $3 trillion, just talking about not the whole government, just part of the government, times 25 years. You got trillions and trillions of dollars. That's just going missing. It's been going on for a long time. And the corporate government that you have elected for yourself, the congressmen and senators and the presidents, haven't really done anything about it. There's been some private citizens, she talks about it, that have gone out and tried to hold the feet of government to the fire. And say you have to get fiscally responsible. Basically, all they were asking for is reporting. What happened to that money? You know, billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, you know, get given to the military to buy submarines. Suddenly, all that money's gone. Nobody knows what happened to it. Can't find out. And there are no more submarines. No new submarines. So where'd it go? So, I mean, the American people, and now that we hear in the news, Somalians pilfering money in Minnesota, it's wandering off somewhere in, you know, Somaliland or wherever. I'm sure a lot of it came back to Americans. A lot of it certainly went to the Somalis. And it wasn't like, you know, whether they got like 8 guys indicted or something. It took hundreds of people to do this. You're talking billions of dollars. Last figure I heard was more than $9 billion illegally absconded with. And this is by Somalians. Meanwhile, all the Minnesotans are, you know, milking their cows and going to work and paying their taxes and they're getting robbed blind. And my emphasis is on blind. So anyway, what does this all have to do with trust? Well, it's all overlapping. You know, when you compare corporations and trusts, I mean, there's non-profit corporations, S corporations, C corporations, there are statutory trusts, there's non-statutory trusts, and of course the title of this particular X space is Sacred Purpose Trusts. And just as a corporation is two or more people gathered together for a particular purpose under a pre-existing authority, those corporations can create trusts. Individuals can create trusts. Usually if it's a corporation of the state, it will create trusts based on statutory limitations and regulations. If it's a sacred purpose trust, in other words, it is a church. If it's the church that creates the trust and the church is separate from the state, then the trust is separate from the state. And now the question is, when you say church, I mean, there's a Church of Satan and there's the Church of Constantine and there's the Church of Jesus Christ. There's the Church of Moses. Church is from the ecclesia, that means the called out, and it talks about the called out in the wilderness, which we have described, refers to the Levites, who were called out of the camp of the golden calf. What was the golden calf? Golden calf was a trust. Yeah, there's a trust. You take all your earrings off, all the gold, you know, at not all your silver earrings, you get to keep your silver, but you take all your gold, which is the most portable form of wealth, and you put that in a golden calf, or, you know, a golden pillar. That's actually going to come up in our study of Leviticus, because there's a reference to a word that actually has to do with it depends on how they translate it. They translate it a couple of different ways, and we'll get into that in more depth when we go back and are looking at Leviticus. I put it already in three different articles, this idea of this golden pillar. This pillar, you know, it has to do with the Temple of Moloch. And, of course, Moloch, that's the story where your children are put into the trust and burned up. Of course, we're talking in Leviticus about items supposedly burned up on the altar, but they're not actually burnt up with actual fire. They're redistributed. And there is a way to redistribute it that is righteous, and there's a way to redistribute it that is not righteous, and they call that strange fire. And we'll talk about that when we study Leviticus. But what I'm throwing out a lot of seeds here. I'd love it if people asked questions and wanted to know about what a sacred purpose trust is. Formulate some good questions and then raise your hand. Ask for a mic, raise your hand, and ask those direct questions. And we'll try to get you real direct answers on this. We only have a couple hours to do this, and literally the subject of trusts and governments and individuals could span, you know, hundreds of hours, because they've, like I said, they've been around for so long. There's so many different kinds, there's different purposes, and just as a corporation is two or more people gathered together for a particular purpose under a pre-existing authority, as if they were one person. That's the complete definition of a corporation. There's still lots of corporate, almost all corporations will have that, even corporation souls. Corporation soul is one. It's not two or more people. You say, well, that's just one person. It's not two or more people. It is two or more people, but they're not linear. They're consecutive. They're going to be, yeah, the successor will be the second person. But it's all the same entity, which gives a corporation a decided advantage over a human living person, because he's going to die, but the corporation never dies, because your new head of the corporation lives on in the next, you know, president of the corporation, owner of the corporation. And you would be shocked to find out how many people use such concepts in law to maintain churches. The Mormon Church does this. Catholic Church does it. Lots of churches do it. A lot more than you would imagine. But they don't tell you about it. So you need somebody. But really, we want to stick close on the subject of how this works. We have a webpage called Sacred Purpose Trust. It has lots of headings, and it's broken down, and it goes through a lot of different ideas and concepts about trust. And if you go to that at preparingyou.com, maybe you'll come up with some questions that will help other people. Even if you think you already know the answer, we'll try to get you an answer that is suitable to you. So if you grab a mic and get ready to be a speaker, then raise your hand. We'll try to call on you for that question. This is a good time for somebody to come up with one of those questions, but I don't see anybody's hand up. So I'm going to, I'll just look at the page. We have Sacred Purpose Trust. In 2 Corinthians, they say, in the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established. So the idea of witnesses, two or three witnesses, that actually, we can find that back in the Old Testament. Two or three witnesses establishes something. So if you're going to establish a trust with two or three witnesses, I see Mark's hand. Let me finish this thought and I'll call on Mark. If you're going to do two or three witnesses as to the existence of a trust, what are the essential elements of the trust? We just talked about a corporation. And a corporation can own a trust, and a trust can own a corporation, but that gets into complicated situations when we look at those things. But a trust is when somebody gives something to somebody else for the benefit of a named beneficiary. So that's basically a trust. That's foundational. Now, you start talking about different kinds of trusts. Well, some of those things will vary. Emphasis will be different. But that's basic. Well, in order to do that, to establish that trust, you're going to need two or three witnesses to establish that trust. You're also going to need that thing that you give to a, you have a grantor who gives and a trustee who receives. And then there could be all kinds of terms to that. But they're receiving it for the benefit of another person, which we call the beneficiary. So, but it's established by two or more witnesses. But let's go to Mark. And Mark, go ahead, if you have a question.
Oh, hi, Gregory. Mainly for the benefit of the listeners, I guess, but, it's in the title, Sacred Purpose Trust. What is that sacred purpose that requires a trust? Maybe just to explain that, and then you sounded like you were going into the basically the meaning of the trust and the structure of the trust and everything, but what is that sacred purpose exactly that a trust is required for?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Especially, you know, like you say, for beginners who haven't heard any of these things, and you have this word floating around, sacred. Of course, we have the word purpose, and we have the word trust. Those are three separate words, three separate ideas. And so let's take a look at the first one, sacred. Sacred has to do with separate. You know, we often think that sacred has to do with holy. But holy, if you look up the origin of the words that we translate into holy, they all have to do with something that is separate. Even the temples. And if you're going to bring your offering to a temple, the original temples were just areas that you brought your offering to. Even in the White Pine Peace Tree of the Seven Nations, it was five originally, but eventually Seven Nations, you know, like Iroquois Nation, Huron Nation, etc. They had an area that was considered a sacred area. When you entered that sacred area, it was for a particular purpose. And it was also for a purpose of sharing. People would bring stuff to that area, often for an immediate meal because they were going to have a meeting, etc. But that's what the temple was. It was an area in which you would, that was considered separate, and you took something there, and you probably would not take it back with you. It would go into the hands of somebody else. And it was for the purposes of creating a trust that was sacred. If you go to the Temple of Janus, it just was basically a walled-in area that had two doors. A door where you brought something in and a door that something went out. And then the stuff that went out might come back and then go out the other door again. And the idea was is that somebody financing an expedition off to go in gold mine or to create a harbor or whatever it was, they brought in their investment in one door and it would go out the other door. And then when it came back, you know, the profits from that investment, it would come back in the door it went out and then could be redistributed out to the people who originally invested in. There was all kinds of bookkeepers there trying to keep track of all that. That was, but they're basically creating a trust. So a sacred purpose trust is a separate trust, separate from something. Trust, of course, by nature is already giving something, a grantor giving something to a trustee. They need to define the purpose of that giving. I'm going to give you this for some purpose. You know, to hold it for my granddaughter. Or to hold it for the community. Or to hold it and redistribute it to the beneficiary, which would be my granddaughter or the community or whoever you named. So these terms need to be witnessed and they should be recorded. As it is written, so also shall it be done. That's an important thing. You just say, well, I told you I wanted that to go to so-and-so, and nobody heard you say it. Well, you haven't really created a trust. You may not trust the guy who abused the gift you gave him, but you're kind of responsible because you didn't write it down. You're depending on people's memory and all kinds of stuff. The essence of the trust is there, but if you're going to create a trust as something recognizable, then you should write it down. So we got sacred, something is separate, and that something is the trust. The sacred is modifying the trust itself. The purpose of the trust is defined, but the trust itself is the idea of giving something to a second party for the purpose, for the benefit of a third party. So you write all that out. So the sacred purpose can change depending on how you write it out. But it, to say, there's all kinds of trusts out there. Statutory trust. I wouldn't call a statutory trust a sacred purpose trust. So what makes the sacred purpose trust a sacred purpose trust as we're defining it here in our text? And that is, if you create a statutory trust, like a corporation creates a trust, an individual creates a trust, and they're creating what they call a statutory trust. They don't always add the word statutory. They just say trust, which adds to the confusion because people don't know. They just assume that it's a statutory trust. If you're talking to attorneys, modern attorneys, licensed attorneys, they think, when you say trust, they're thinking statutory trust because that's what they do. But if you say a sacred purpose trust, that isn't necessarily statutory from their point of view. They might recognize that it exists, but they have no jurisdiction over it. They don't, you know, it's outside of the realm of what they do. They're licensed to operate statutory trusts or create statutory trusts. But the sacred purpose trust, and the best thing to do here is to give an example. If Christ appointed apostles a kingdom, because that's what he did. He said to his apostles, I appoint unto you a kingdom. If Moses called out men, just like Jesus called out men, called them the called out, we translate that word ecclesia as called out, and appointed those men to perform a certain task for the community, which he said three times, feed my sheep, feed my sheep, feed my sheep, then that's the purpose of anything that he gives them or anything anybody else gives them is to feed my sheep. So when he says, I appointed unto you a kingdom, he's doing two things. He's actually creating a corporate government, but it's a corporation of Christ. It's not a corporation of Constantine. It's not a corporation of the United States government. But there's an element of trust there, because he's been talking about charity from the beginning. John the Baptist talked about charity from the beginning, but they're talking about this idea of giving something to the called out for the purposes of God, Moses, Christ, which they define throughout the text, the biblical text. And the beneficiary is who? And this is where people get a little bit confused, but it's very simple. The beneficiary is God. But God doesn't need your stuff. So he is the beneficiary, but the people, because he wants you to feed my sheep, so the sheep now are the representative beneficiary. It goes to God by going to the sheep. So this is the elements of the trust. It's separate, sacred, because the apostles were called out, the Levites were called out. The apostles were to live in the world, but not of the world. They're not of the world. They're of the kingdom of God, this separate entity. And whatever they receive is not going into a statutory trust. It's going into the government of God, which is in the United States is supposed to be, the church is supposed to be separate from the state. Now, most churches go out and get 501c3 status by filling out a 1023, or they incorporate under the state. And if you read the corporate laws, many states, all states have similar phraseology. Illinois says anyone who incorporates under the statutes of the state of Illinois, all other previous incorporation is null and void. So any church that did that would no longer be sacred. They wouldn't be separate from the world. They would now be a corporation of the world. So it was very important to Moses. It was actually even important to Jacob. We won't go into that. It's more obvious because a lot more written about what Moses was doing. And of course, that's what the studies that we started by going into Leviticus. We've talked about it before many times, but so yeah, sacred is separate from most other trusts. And this is what you see. If Terah, the father of Abraham, worked for Nimrod, or, you know, the city of Ur, and was called an idolater, and we've explained that elsewhere, we'll get too long into it, but basically, he was not separate from Nimrod. He was not separate from Ur. He was a part of it, he was working for it. But he did separate himself. He gathered up all his possessions, which included a lot of people, a lot of stuff, went to Haran, started another city-state. But to Abraham, that wasn't enough, and he believed that God wanted us to come out of this idea of creating these city-states like Abimelech and stuff, and do this other thing that Abraham was doing, and people can go back to our study on Genesis and find out what Abraham was doing. But Abraham separated from his family, from Haran, from his nativity. So now he becomes this separate individual out there doing something different. So, and it's our contention, we explained in a lot of other places in details, the altars were trusts. The stones of the altar were the trustees. They're actually living stones back then, originally. And they would receive the offerings of the people. That had to be free will offering. We just covered that in our study of Leviticus 1. We've mentioned it hundreds of times, but it's a free will offering. When it's given to the stone of the altar, the human being who's gathered together with other human beings to receive the contributions of the people, that the item going to these human beings is now separated from the person who gave it, the grantor, he's granted it, and it is now in the hands of this second party, who would be called a trustee. We call them stones of the altar. They don't regulate one another. They're not passing rules like you can only spend the money on this. The original grantor, he's given up the choice of it entirely. But he doesn't have to give it up next week. So he can watch those guys and see how well they do. See, like when I just posted the thing on Catherine Austin Fitz, who I've met, talked with many years ago, she's saying that somebody's walking away with trillions of dollars and we can't do anything about it. We have to keep giving them money and they're walking away. That's a different kind of trust. That isn't set up like the sacred purpose trust of Christ. And Christ talked about this stuff all the time. It's amazing that people just miss it. You know, he talks about treasuries. Well, a lot of the golden calf was a treasury. It was a trust. They entrusted their wealth in the golden calf, and they all owned it collectively, but they didn't have control over it anymore. The priests had control over it. And Moses said, no, we don't want to do it that way. But today, everybody's done it that way. That's why there's a Fort Knox. So anyway, I don't know if that helps, but sacred means separate. So if it's modifying trust, and it actually is also modifying purpose, because the purpose is not going to be for the purpose of everybody else. It's going to be for the purposes of the terms of the trust. So that sacred purpose trust is separate from the trust. And of course, that's what people were trying to do. We'll run back real quick, take a look at what William the Conqueror was doing. People were setting up trusts. They were taking the title to their property and putting it into trust with the church. So if they got into trouble with any of the lords of William the Conqueror, and they came over and said, he defrauded me, he infringed on my rights or whatever, and tried to sue him or conquer him, you know, trial by combat, they couldn't get his property from him because he already put it into a trust. This is going to be a very important concept before we end today, but I can't go into great details, but I'm just showing you, I'm going to lay out the landscape. If people can come up with good questions, we can get into the details. But there's a reason that everything is going on in a bigger picture. Well, he passed two statutes with his parliament, signed them in French, because all the laws had to be written in French for almost 300 years there after William the Conqueror. All the laws made by William the Conqueror. He didn't own all of England. Like I say, there were two laws. Common law, if you didn't take an oath of fealty to William the Conqueror, and you only had to if you were helping Harold. So there were lots of people, lots of lands that were not under the authority of William the Conqueror. If he came to your door, he had to knock on your door to ask permission to come in. And all the law was handled locally through the common law, not through the laws that he was passing in his parliament. So there were literally two kingdoms in operation at that time. One was top down, and the other one was, as the common law originally meant, from the bottom up. But over the next 200, 300, 400, 500 years, the common law kingdom began to disappear more and more. Rights began to disappear more and more. But anyway, but what he did is he passed the Statute of Uses, or Statutes of Mortmain. Mortmain means dead hand. And it said that if you do that now, if you create that trust now, or at the beginning of a dispute that you have with one of my lords, it doesn't count. It's a dead hand. We will disregard that trust because you're just doing it to get out of your responsibilities. And we still have that concept in law now. If you're getting old, you're 80, 90 years old, and you got a big estate and you want to start dispersing it to your children, and you try to, if you give over 10, I think 10,000, it's different in different states, but if you give too much to your children within 10 years before you actually die, it isn't tax free. You know, you can gift a certain amount, but you can't gift the whole thing. Because they've got, and now they're talking about doing away with the inheritance tax. It never should have been. Inheritance tax is always robbing the widows and orphans. But most people don't even know how these laws go. They get upset and they, you know, they make a complaint on Facebook or something, but they don't do anything about it. And they're incapable of really doing anything about it because they have abandoned the ways of the kingdom. And of course, that's what happened back in Samuel 8, but we won't get off on that tangent. But if somebody has a question, I can explain that. So anyway, I don't know if that helps. Mark, you want a follow-up question or anything? And I'm looking for other hands now.
You know, I think the sacred purpose, you know, talking about is the sacred purpose of Christ, which is, like you said, feeding my sheep, setting the captives free, you know, the salvation of mankind, basically. That's the purpose of the cross.
Yeah.
He
wants the captive to be set free and still alive. Which is, you know, like, after slavery and everything, there was a Negro spiritual that said, free at last, thank God Almighty, he's free at last. And they used to sing it at funerals. We want you to be free and still alive.
That's God is the God of the living.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
I think you made a very interesting point that a lot of people don't understand, especially, you know, sovereign citizen types or whatever you want to call them, you know, freedom types, where they kind of know that, you know, they've got to set up a trust of some sort, they kind of do it not for the sacred purpose that you're talking about, usually just to set themselves free. And you're talking about the trusting God, where, you know, you're actually becoming a part of the body of Christ, the corpus of Christ, which administers the trust. Whereas these other trusts that are set up by these, you know, freedom type guys, you know, the church is not involved. It's just them and other people. They're not really part of that body of Christ. Although they are, there's a difference. You know, they're still, like you said, a part of the body of the state. But I just thought that was an interesting, because I don't think many people considered the concept of the church administering that trust. So that's
correct.
Very important.
Yeah, the church trust is the social welfare system of the people. That's its purpose. Its purpose is you give to God so that we can feed God's sheep. You know, that, so the beneficiary we say is Christ, but Christ said, feed my sheep 3 times, and he said this in a lot of ways. John the Baptist said the same thing. The reality is that's the purpose of the trust, the sacred purpose trust of the church. But now what you're talking about brings in very interesting aspects, and I'll address that. Try to keep it brief. I'm working on my brevity. But first we'll look at sovereign citizen. A sovereign is somebody who makes law. So the reality is sovereign citizen can be a very ambiguous term. If I return every man to his family and every man to his possession, they have every right to make law concerning their family and their possessions. They don't have any right to make law for anybody else. So usually when we use that word sovereign, we're talking about some king or duke or, you know, prime minister who's going to make, you know, legislature is going to make laws for all the people who are subject to that legislature. And so it's not really the best of terms. If we're very careful in defining it, we could use it, but I don't recommend using it. I don't even like using the word trust a lot of times, because most people will think you're talking statutory trusts of the king. And of course, we're talking about trusts of the King of Kings. So that's a different thing. But now I mentioned the statute of mortmain, dead hand. Most of the people trying, and I've visited them in jail. I warned them about this. They're trying to create a trust and get all their stuff out of the system into their control where the government can't touch it. And I mean, that's a very complicated area and you have to look at all the details, but 99% of the time, most of the sovereign citizens thinking they're doing that, they're just, it's just a smokescreen. That's not really protecting them. Now, most people, we've already covered this elsewhere, you don't own your land, you don't own your car, you got a legal title to your car, and they say, well, I have a right to travel. You do, but you can't take your car because it's not your car. You only have a legal title to it, and that legal title is regulated over there in that equity thing. And so people say, well, how do I get to own my own car? Well, you don't own your own self because you're probably a surety for debt. Now, there's a lot of people out there, and maybe not everybody isn't, but if you're eligible for the benefits of a corporation, then you're also responsible for the debt of the corporation. So you're also a surety for debt. These are complicated things and we're going through them really fast and people don't get them. Ask a question. But the reality is that it's very difficult to remove yourself once you become a surety for debt, which is why they have all this debt. I mean, most of the trillions of dollars being stolen all the time and embezzled from the government. That's just because people are greedy. The ultimate goal. Somebody said the other day on the news that Obamacare never worked. Obamacare worked exactly as it was meant to work. Now, a lot of people may have to look up what I'm about to say. Go to preparingyou.com, look up Cloward and Piven. Or just look up the word Piven and you'll find Cloward and Piven strategy. These are professors. They wrote all kinds of books on a strategy to how to bring in a communist government. And one of the main factors was to create a welfare state and overburden that welfare state until you bankrupted the nation. And that was the purpose of Obamacare. And people say, oh, that's mean to say about Obama. Obama had Cloward and Piven as his personal guests at the White House numerous times. He was an advocate. He was a fan of Cloward and Piven, whose all their books are about bankrupting the government that uses capitalism or any kind of government that uses capitalism so they can usher in socialism and communism. It's not a secret. They wrote all kinds of books about it. You can buy the books on Amazon. But nobody's going to tell you but us. Almost nobody. There might be somebody else out there. But the reality is that you're a surety for debt. Your land is a surety for debt. Your car is a surety for debt. This has all come about because of the original golden calf in the United States, which was the Federal Reserve, which is started way back there in 1913, etc. And a lot of other things we can talk about, but goes into too depth. You can't just remove yourself. There is a way to get out of the system, but if you just want to get out of the system, you're not going to make it. The reason everybody has been brought into this system, which is literally the bondage of Egypt or mystery Babylon, which is secret Babylon. It's Babylon, period. The reason everybody has gone into that system is because they didn't care about their neighbor's rights. They were engaged in covetous practices. They were slothful. If you're slothful, you're going to be under tribute. The Bible tells you that. If you desire benefits at the expense of others, you're going to be in a snare and a trap. So if you want to be free, you have to change that thinking, which is the purpose, part of the purpose of a sacred purpose trust, is to teach the people how to start caring about the liberty of others as much as they care about their own liberty. which is what the Israelites were learning to do when they were in the bondage of Egypt. And in that period of time where there were plagues and famine, that they were having to take care of one another, not look to the government, but start looking to one another. And they were already doing it because of the laws, and we've talked about that in our study of Exodus. They were already doing that in Egypt. And were crying out because the burden was great, but because the burden was great, they were having more children. They were trying to limit it to one child per family, but they were still having them. And their numbers are still going up. And the Egyptian people, their birth rate was going down. Why? Because the Egyptian people had free access to socialism and social welfare through the state. And burdens were being put on the Israelites, so their birth rate went up. And I can explain that. But the reality is they had to learn to take care of one another so they'd be ready for freedom. They'd be ready to own their own house and their own family, and be sovereigns within that family. But in order to maintain that, they had to care about their neighbor's family. And not just their next door neighbor, but people all across the spectrum of what we call Israel. And you had to do it with voluntary contributions. And that's... So what you're learning to do is to care for one another on a national basis. That's part of the purpose of the Sacred Purpose Trust. It's spelled out somewhere in the original 20, you know, items that we list off as the purpose of the trust. But in essence, the world has been trying to kill care in the people. If you don't care about your neighbor and your neighbor's freedom, you're much easier to control. Because they can steal, you know, $3 trillion. And you can only get a handful of people who want to even make noise about it. Because the people, they don't care until it affects them. And then when they care, they have no trust or connection with anybody else. What they have done, because they're in Babylon now, what was the thing that happened in Babylon? The people were divided. They couldn't understand each other. We talk about their language. Their communication was no longer communicating. And eventually they developed other languages. But basically, they divided the people so that people didn't care about one another. And that always happens in socialist nations. They just don't care about one another. What I read a statistic today, I think it's like 72 or 78% of the immigrants in Sweden go back and visit the countries they said they were seeking asylum from. And like 60 to 70% of those people are on social welfare in Sweden. And the Swedes, they don't like it. They're afraid to say anything, but they're a nation of Swedes and they're all divided. And the reason they're divided is they have not created the social bonds that comes when you have to care about your neighbor as much as you care about yourself. Because the idea of socialism, which is a public religion, is that your neighbor doesn't care about you, the state does. The state is your father. So to reverse that process in the minds of the hearts of the people, you create a sacred purpose trust. You list the purpose of the trust is to care about the true needy of society in a way that will strengthen them. But there's a secondary purpose of teaching every individual in the community not only to care about their neighbor, but to consummate that care about their neighbor by a free will sacrifice. Now, what do I mean by that? I'll touch on that and I'll look for more questions in just a second. Adam knew his wife and she gave birth to a child. He didn't just read about his wife, read about Eve. He didn't just get introduced to her. He didn't get a photograph and put it in his wallet. He actually physically knew her, and there was a sacrifice, what the French call petitus mortis, little death. And then she conceived, and now she's sacrificing for him. And of course, he's continually sacrificing for her because he's helping, you know, protecting her from lions and tigers and bears and starvation. And she's going to produce an heir so that he actually has a family to return to. It's built into the system to teach you to care about one another. Well, that's on a family basis, but on a national basis, you have to do the same thing. You have to invest in your neighbor. Sacrifice for your neighbor. Now, anybody can go out and help the guy next door, and he may appreciate it, but that's not national. That's block, that's a little tiny block kingdom. So they created a system of tens, hundreds, and thousands so that when you sacrifice on those living altars, you end up developing care for other people way off, because maybe you guys have a fire come through, burns all your wheat. You know, one of these grass fires comes through, burns everybody's wheat. There's no wheat to harvest in this area. The news goes out through their tens, hundreds, and thousands. People who did grow wheat in other areas send wheat to your area. And they know to do it because they have an element of trust with the ministers, because they've been doing this for a long time. And people will know, oh, well, this, it didn't come just from George Soros or this rich guy over here. It came from a network of contributions that came in. It wasn't just a GoFundMe, but it's like a GoFundMe, but it also creates bonds through that church, through that called out group that is providing for the needs. They were doing this in early America. There was no social welfare other than that kind of thing. You know, obviously, you had your local churches, but at times, you know, crops failed. And people needed assistance. And so they had the tens, hundreds, and thousands in early America. And they helped one another out when those Indian uprisings, when there was terrible storms, crop failures, what have you. And they helped one another out. Well, when they had the American Revolution, they also helped one another out through the same networks. Today, we don't have that. I was walking with a guy out of a gun store. Somebody I was with stopped in a gun store, and I was talking to this old guy, and he looked like he needed help. He was buying a big gun and a gun case, and he was going out to his car, and he could hardly walk. He was overweight, something wrong with his feet. And he's talking about, we need a revolution in this country. He's not going to fight it. And he doesn't know anybody else hardly, other than a few buddies that he might go out to the woods with in Tarka practice. Not that, I'm encouraging that. Most people, when you have major upheavals in society, they die of the famine and the food shortages and the disease, and they don't die from bullets. They die from the chaos. But the reality is that the reason you're ill-equipped for whatever chaos may come is because you haven't been spending any time or energy taking care of one another. And that's what Moses was teaching the people. So they became a nation of people entirely supported by free will offerings. This is what Abraham was doing. We discovered that in the study of Abraham. This is what Jacob was learning to do when he got the name Israel. He was learning how to take care of one another, not through systems of social welfare, through men who exercise authority from the top down. Why was he doing that? For the same reason Christ forbid us to do that. Yet the modern church does it. Sacred purpose trusts their purpose is to repent, think differently, and go the other way, which is the way of Christ, which was the way of the early church, who were persecuted because they would not apply for benefits at the state religion, the socialistic state-run government temples of Rome. They would not apply for that free bread. Today, all modern Christians do. But it's because they've had blind guides for, 100 years. And dim-eyed guides for maybe 50 years before that. But anyway, I'll look again for hands, see if any questions come up. And I can only look down at the screen for a little bit at a time. So the first part of this thing is sacred purpose trust. And the reason people don't own their own land, they have legal title, that does not, by definition, include the beneficial interest or beneficial use, they call it sometimes, which is why you have to pay a use tax on your land, a use tax on your car. Yeah, even your income tax is really a use tax in most cases. And although there's somewhat of a debate in that, but it's pretty clear that it is a use tax on your own labor. But that's what it was when you had to pay 20% to the Pharaoh. That was a use tax. That 20% is a use tax. You got to keep 80% of your labor and whatever you produce. But the fact that they spell that out in the Bible, that was a grant. That 80% was a grant by the Pharaoh in the contract that everybody was making when they said, you give us free bread, help us through this famine, and we will owe you 80% of, 20% of our labor, and we'll get to keep 80%. And that was to be a law forever. And I've explained that was still the law in Egypt when I wrote the book Covenants of the Gods. That was 20%. Go ahead.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I think I can see your hand.
Yeah, I do. I do see
just,
that.
Just missed. Oh, okay. Sorry.
Well, I saw it when you spoke up, so thanks for speaking up. Yeah, so, Arus, I don't see the whole name, Arust, you got your hand up?
Yes, it's Arus, it's Josh.
Josh, okay, so you have a question?
How are you? First of all, you said, I have a few questions, but you said at the beginning that, the Melchizedek, had a trust, or
elements of a trust.
I was wondering.
Elements of a trust.
And
the way it is Abraham was tithing to Melchizedek of Salem, which means righteous king of peace. In Hebrews, he's referred to as king and high priest. Always, priests are receiving funds for the purpose of redistribution to somebody else. He was a righteous king. He was... if he was Shem, which I believe he was, other people don't have to believe that. I got a lot of evidence to prove that. It was commonly accepted for thousands of years that Melchizedek was Shem, who, according to Bible chronologies, were still living at that time. And we never saw who Shem blessed as heir to what Shem owned. So he's both kind of a corporation soul as king, but as priest, he is receiving tithings, not to enrich himself, but to provide for other people. So that's elements of a trust.
Okay, you use the word corporation soul, but a corporation is a creature of the state.
Well, not necessarily. You're right. Most of the time when we use a corporation is two or more people. Go ahead.
Well, two more people. Corporation is for a benefit.
No.
We're the liability normally.
Well, statutory corporations are usually created for limited liability. Absolutely. But again, if the fundamental nature of a corporations, which existed long before the creation of the state, is two or more people gather together as if they were one person under a pre-existing authority for a particular purpose. So that's a fundamental definition of corporations for thousands of years. There's all kinds of corporations, but that's the fundamental elements of a corporation. Well, that just described a family. So a family, we wouldn't call a family a corporation, but a family has the elements of a corporation. A family is created by God, male and female, no more twain, but one flesh. We see Jesus using those same terms. For what purpose? To be fruitful and to multiply. And God, Moses, Jesus Christ, when he sets the captive free, the purpose is to return every man to his family. That corpus of a family. Now, almost all governments are based on the law of the Father, which goes back to the family, but now they're creating a corporation where a portion of the rights of the natural family, Father, are now held by this other kind of state agreement corporation. The United States was a corporation when they first signed the Constitution. It didn't become a corporation. The nature of that corporation might have shifted a little bit in the 1870s, but it was already a corporation. You know this just by reading the Constitution. It was two or more people gathered together for a particular purpose as if they were one person. And it wasn't to obtain limited liability. In that case, it was to supposedly form a more perfect union and to guarantee liberty and all the things that they listed. That's their listed purpose. And to promote the general welfare, not individual welfare. But at that time, the people of America were not a party to the Constitution. They would have to contract to the entities created by the Constitution to become parties to the Constitution. And of course, they've done that. So a corporation is just that simple for two or more people. This is why I say adjectives are important. Are we talking a statutory corporation? A corporation in Saudi Arabia may be much different than a corporation in the United States, but they have basically the same elements. And so that's why I define these at the beginning. A lot of people don't want to let go of the fact they want to, you say trust, they're thinking only statutory trusts. And like I say, when you talk to an attorney, that's what he's, cause that's all he's going to be in charge of. You know, if you go get married with a marriage license, you're creating a different entity than you would have if you just married your spouse before witnesses. And most states, California states it very clear. It's a three-party agreement. State licensed marriage is a three-party agreement between you, your spouse, and the state. And in most states, I could almost say all states, the state has a preponderance of the power over that union. You've created an entity called a family, and they even write it this way if you read like Clark Summy v. American Law. When you're married at common law, married at, in the natural state of husband and wife, both the word husband and wife are capitalized. It's called the great domestic relationship. But if you're married in equity, the words husband and wife are no longer capitalized, and it actually say you take this woman for your wife. In legal terminology, the word for means instead of. So vocabulary is very important, understanding these things, and that adds to the confusion. But I'm very specific and when I'm talking about these things. Corporation soul, every family should be a corporation soul. We don't call it a corporation soul because the state has this other thing they call a corporation soul, and we don't want to confuse the issues. But the same, they got the elements for a corporation soul in their statutory, legislated law system created under their corporation called the United States. They got the idea for that from the family. The father dies, blesses his sons, you know, names his heir, maybe it's the eldest, gets the bulk of the estate. The eldest is supposed to be the high priest of the family. He gets the bulk of the estate to make sure all the other siblings get, you know, college education or get started in business. He gets that to help them. But then he's also creating his own family based off of those resources. So that's basically what a corporation soul does, is it passes from one head of the family. When the father dies, there's a new head of the family. And he is operating, hopefully, for the same purposes of his father. That's the essence of a corporation soul. But usually when we use the word corporation soul, we're talking about a statutory corporation of souls. I do not advise any churches, many people do this. I know people have been doing it, offering packets so that the church organizes as a corporation soul. That's not the way Christ did it. But there's elements in a corporation soul you'll find in the church, but it doesn't really qualify as a statutory corporation of soul, especially if the ministers of the church are not numbered members of the public religion of the United States, which is Social Security. They don't have Social Security numbers. They're not numbered in the state. They would be separate, because the state, you know, like the United States, that's the world. The word world we often see in the Bible is constitutional order or system of government. Ordained ministers of the church should not be members of the government. If you have a Social Security number, you're a member of the government. That's your member ID. Just like you went and got baptized by the Pharisees, so you get access to the Corban of the Pharisees, the benefits. They would give you a Hebrew name, and that had a numerical value. So it's the same exact system that Jesus said was making the word of God to none effect. So we're trying to describe the system that Christ put in its place. He didn't do away with it. The Romans did away with it. At least, you know, they're the ones who confiscated all the gold in their temple and dispersed all the Jews who were. And it was the same Jews who a few years before said we had no king but Caesar. So. But there's two different systems going on there. There's what Christ set up and what the Pharisees set up, which was contrary to the ways of Moses. And we show this all the time. But the essence of a corporation that the state creates is based on the family. That's why Abimelech, father king. That's why Caesar was called Patronus, our father who art in Rome. That's why the senators were called Patri. That's why, I think it's title 15, section 15, could be title 8, section 15, but anyway, in the U.S. codes, you can look it up on our page on Patri or parents, Patria. We have several articles, or Patronus. You can look it up and find links to it. That the modern government is based on the concepts that were created for the original family, which is in essence a corporation of God. It's two or more, it's a corpus of God. Two or more people gathered together for his purposes under his authority. And that's why I wrote the book Covenants of the Gods, so I show you how you can abandon that liberty under God by applying for the benefits under the fathers of the state. That's why David says it, Proverbs says it, we see it definitely in the life of Abraham, we see it in the, you know, in the bondage of Egypt, we see it, Christ talks about it, call no man father, and modern church ministers actually say, we're not to call our natural father, father. He thinks that, they actually think that that's what Jesus was talking about. But even...
Can I ask you another question?
Sure, absolutely.
You said at the beginning that if a church creates a trust, it's separate. My question is if a church doesn't create a trust, what can it do that it can do with that trust?
if the church doesn't create a trust,
what can it do that it can't, what can't it do that it can with?
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit, but I think I'm following your question. Let's see if this helps. Again, don't get hung up on the word trust. A lot of times when
Hold on, let's operate there. The reason why I get hung up in a trust, because from my understanding, a trust is strictly a product of equity, which is strictly separate from God's law.
No.
And so when we're talking about creating, hold on, when we're talking about creating a trust, because I can think that real and personal property, which is all equity. There's no real personal property in God's law. We deal in private property, which is different. And trusts don't deal in private property. So I am wondering how this is separate, what the church can do with the trust, what the aim is to have a trust. Why the church trust when the church is separate?
Yeah, a lot of your words are cut out probably by the internet, but I think I'm following what you're saying. And again, if you take a sheep and give it to the priests in Leviticus, and they put their hands on it and cut it up, and it actually says, you know, they talk about wood and fire. We'll talk about it next week. It's trying to explain the Hebrew language there. I've done a lot of work on that just today. You're creating the elements, and I've said this over and over again, elements of a trust. You're taking something you have and you're giving it to a secondary party, not to enrich him, but for another beneficiary that's somewhere else. This is what the altars were. They were the basic primary idea of giving something to one party for the benefit of another party. Now, you're imposing statutory trust rules on that deal. That's real property. I mean, when I say real property, I don't mean like land. Land is what we often call real property. And nobody really owns the land. They have a property right in the land. But anyway, go ahead with your question.
No, I was just going to say, again, the reason why I say that is because trust only deal with real and personal property, which means it's a total creation of equity.
No, it deals with whatever you give. I just described that the element of a trust is that you take something you have a right to and you give it to a second party for a particular purpose, and benefit of a third party. That's the elements of a trust. No statutes needed.
But my problem with that is that, you know, I'm thinking from a point of a zealous prosecutor who wants to tear this apart.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
And if it's a trust, they can take control of it.
No.
There is no.
Not if it's a sacred trust. Not if it's
okay. Where can I get that information outside of your mouth? So can I go to Corpus Juris or Corpus Juris Secundum and read that in the trust?
Well, the trust? Why are you looking for rules of a trust outside of their jurisdiction in their jurisdiction?
We're dealing with U.S. citizens in the United States, and I'm assuming that we're dealing with Federal Reserve notes.
Well, actually, we don't start. We record the first. For one thing, Federal Reserve notes don't automatically put you under the jurisdiction of the United States. Federal Reserve notes are used all over the world. The problem with Federal Reserve notes is they have no value.
But all over the world, there is a duty due to anyone who uses them. It doesn't matter where they are. It doesn't matter what their journey. If the Beatles come in and do a tour, they got to pay the taxes on the money they make.
Well, if the Sheikh of Saudi Arabia comes into the United States, he can make millions of dollars and not pay any taxes on it. I actually know somebody who used to work for the Federal Reserve, and he said back in 1965 and 66, the Sheikh of Saudi Arabia, sending, you know, ambassadors over here, would cash Federal Reserve notes in for, you know, like a $20 bill in for an ounce of gold. He would have to pay $20, I think, in 76 cents to get a coin of the realm, U.S. coin, in gold, $20 in the 60s. And he didn't have to pay any tax on it. And he got, if you as a citizen of the United States went and tried to buy an ounce of gold at that time, I can't remember what it was. It was probably about 70 bucks. But he could come in and buy it from the Federal Reserve.
And at that time, any foreigner could exchange.
Not any foreigner. Not any foreigner, but somebody who was that sovereign of a nation. Because he was getting that exchange in the Law of Nations. It was shortly after that they started saying, and they had I've gone through the whole history of all the treaties that they were making. 97-98% of all nations had a Federal Reserve system. So the U.S. Federal Reserve system could coerce those countries into waiving their right to redeem Federal Reserve notes in gold or silver. And that's what they did. That's how Panama got the Panama Canal, because Panama didn't have a Federal Reserve system. But Panama does now. East Timor has now. I think Afghanistan does now. I know Iran does now. They didn't have them, but now almost everybody's got one. There's probably, Iran might not have one now, which might be part. Libya didn't have one. They got one now. and yeah, it's pervasive. But I don't have one. And I'm not considered a citizen of the United States.
May I just interject?
Sure.
Just for a moment. Because the question from the gentleman was, if you are brought before the magistrate and you have to explain the sacred purpose trust, where does he go to describe or define it? And, you know, you have literature with footnotes that describes, let's say, the formation of a sacred purpose trust using the sacred purpose trust form, that each line of that form has a basis in law that you can point to.
Right.
Or scripture. So maybe we could drill down there and explain that.
Well, the Free Church Report has lots of footnotes, including case law, Social Security law, quoting, the Supreme Court, et cetera, throughout the book. And one of the things, my first argument would be, probably, I don't want to say, create a strategy or anything, but is it not lawful to do with mine own what I will? And, basically they have to prove a nexus between me and them. And we show in the Free Church Report that a minister who is actually organizing himself with other ministers for the purposes of Christ, according to the directives of Christ, if you look in the statutes of the United States, they say, you're mandatorily accepted from having to file. You're whatever you are given in, like you can work somewhere and they can look like they're paying you. Let me finish this one thought. And they look like they're paying you. It's not trade or business. Even though they said, well, that looks like business. You did that work. They paid you. It's not trade or business. That's in their laws. And it's not in their laws because they like me. There's another reason why it's in their laws, but that's another whole subject. But go ahead with what you were asking.
Well, I was going to say that this seems to me would be a benefit granted by Congress to use the Fed notes without penalty.
Well, they wouldn't say that you're mandatorily accepted from even having to file. That you don't have to file a 1023, you don't have to claim to be a church as a 501c3, you're considered that automatically. Now, you could say that they're granting it, but that's not what we're saying. We're just saying that we're the church, and they're saying that, actually, case law goes way back in the United States, that they recognize that the church is separate. I've been in court where the judge says, we don't have any jurisdiction. And they dismiss the case. And the lawyers thought they had jurisdiction, but the judge said, we don't have any jurisdiction. They tried to, they were supposedly, they named, they were going to subpoena me. And they knew who I was, but they didn't subpoena me, but I showed up anyway. And they thanked me for showing up and apologized for having, and I said, well, I know that nobody ever issued me a subpoena, but, you know, basically I have said almost nothing. I didn't even stand up when the judge addressed me. He made everybody else stand up, but he didn't make me stand up. Why is that? I'm not that scary. Now, I'm not going to guarantee you that all judges are going to recognize. We've seen a bevy of judges breaking the law on a regular basis. But, I mean, these are the arguments, you know, on our website, we have case law that goes all the way back to Saturninus, where the same thing was argued. And some of the people lost the case. Well, so to speak, they lost the case. They were martyred. But many others were left alone because of the fact that the church should be a separate jurisdiction of the state, and we have constitutions, the Bill of Rights are not a granting of rights.
And so that's why this being called a church and ministry is enough. Why do we have to bring in this word trust?
Hey, Acoustic, you're breaking up quite badly. Perhaps you can move to another area of the house or something like that. It is a little bit hard to understand. And by the way, while I've just got the mic here, I've got that documentation that Gregory was talking about, the Free Church Report that goes through these concepts with footnotes. I don't have a purple pill that I can post it to, but I've followed you, Acoustic. If you follow me back, I can direct message that PDF for you, just to let you know.
If you go to hisholychurch.org, there's a search engine on almost every page, and you just type in free church report, it will take you to a link that has it in PDF format where you can download it for free. But anyway.
I bought your books. Can you hear me?
Okay, I hear you now. But in PDF form, you can do word searches and that sort of thing on the document, and that sometimes helps you. But anyway, we make it all available for free, and of course, they pay Sacred Purpose Trust. The reality is what I said at the very beginning, it requires two or three witnesses that all things should be established. So, yeah, we create a what doesn't look like a statutory trust by people who are not members of the statutory government to, and we announce to the world that we're doing it for the purposes of Christ. So you see that we're, if you don't notify them that, you know, it's like if you have every right to ride a black bicycle wearing all black down the highway at midnight. You have every right to do that, but you might get run over. So I would recommend that you announce to the world with a colorful vest and a light that you're on the side of the road and don't hit me. And so that's why you create a sacred purpose trust, separate trust, And you can only do that if you have people that are separate. And, of course, at the beginning of this, Mark brought it up. There are a lot of people who want to just separate themselves out while they're still living, and sometimes even living of the world, and say that we're separate. That even if they don't mean sovereign like a king, but they're sovereign over their family and their possessions. That's why I wrote the book Covenants to God. You can find it the same way at hisholychurch.org, that the covenants of the gods is the contractual nature of how you get into bondage. 15 chapters showing you at least 15 different ways. And of course, all these things have hundreds of biblical quotes. And, you know, now that we're going through a lot of these, you know, I have the Greek and Hebrew in the book, Covenants of the Gods, as well. But we're doing a lot more work showing you that if you have an appetite for benefits from rulers, that he's going to give you dainties, benefits, that are deceitful meats, that are a snare and a trap. David said it, Proverbs says it, Paul says it in the New Testament. This is what everybody's done. You can't just do away with that. You can't free yourself with paperwork, but you can turn around your thinking. And
I agree with that. I've gone to a certain point myself, and I don't want to take a step backwards. That's my concern here.
Right. Well, the fact is now this would be a good part. We talked about sacred purpose trust. You have a grantor, somebody who gives to the trust, but he entirely gives it up. What he gives up. A lot of people who create trusts to get their property out of the system, they create a trust and then they run around the table and then they become the trustee. Or they appoint their buddy to be the trustee and they tell him everything he can do in the trust, and it's a fraud. And they might get away with it for a while because it's difficult to prove, and maybe they don't have much and the government's too busy going after $9 billion of Somali corruption or whatever. Because there's an awful lot of people in Congress that probably ought to be in jail, but they would rather put the Somalis in jail. But anyway, the point is that grantor, not a party to the trust. He was in the moment he granted, but he's not a party to the trust anymore because he has no authority over the trust. He doesn't elect new trust members. He doesn't elect new trustees. He's done his part. He's completely given it up. And the trustee doesn't own it. It's very clear. We've written it down so that any lawyer can read it, that the beneficiary is Jesus Christ, and we have documents 2,000 years old saying what Christ's purpose was. So the purpose of the trust is set the captive free. We just saw in Carolinas when they had the hurricane and people sent food. I thought it was really great that a lot of Christian groups went out there and sent food to help the people and all this stuff. And they put it in the local school to be distributed. And FEMA came in and just took it all. Why? Because nobody created a trust. Nobody was in authority. Well, they gave it to us. Well, we're taking it. Well, could they do that? When Israel, when there was the famines in Egypt, we don't see any case where the Pharaoh came and started taking food away from the Israelites during the famines. When we finally see them trying to do it, they all end up at the bottom of the Red Sea. And in order to do that, I think you have to conform to Christ. And so everything that we're doing, and again in the book, we're showing you how Christ is doing it. The person who gives to us, he's not a party, so he's not in danger of anything. He has no control over it. He hasn't put it in a trust that, you know, I know guys who did that. They had lots of money. They were making really lots of money and they were putting money in that trust and then they wanted to run around and control it. They haven't given it away yet. Almost every Protestant church does the same thing. where they give money to the church, but they're on the board. So then they get on the board and decide what's going to be done with the money they gave away. Well, they didn't really give it away. Now they get away with it because the legal statutes let them do that, but they haven't really given it away. And Christ sees that. So it's very important that when you give an offering, it is given up. Now, next week, if you don't like what he did with it, don't give it to him. Most of the money that is in the kingdom should be in your pocket, in your control. We're not building a golden calf. We're not creating a big central bank. We're not, you know, I get almost no donations from anybody. And that's the way I've set it up. You join a local congregation and you give your donation to the local minister. I either make the money myself or I'm helped out from other members in the order. And occasionally people do send me a little bit of money, but most of that is sent me, I set aside to be used for the purpose of the church. I don't live off of that money. But, all the eggs I ate today, my chickens laid. So, and I did that just before the show. But, this is working out your salvation. Probably the important thing is Christ created a government. He appointed a government. And he laid down all kinds of criteria, and we have that also in the Free Church Report. And, most churches don't do that. Most churches send all their parishioners or their members to men who exercise authority one over the other to get 90% of their benefits. And according to the U.S. codes, that is parens patria, that is the state being your father, provides you with your welfare. That all that should be done through the family and through free assemblies. That's the way Israel did it. That's the way the early church did it. And we're trying to show you how you could do that today. Ultimately, if you do everything just perfectly, according to those rules set down by Christ and everything, you're still not going to be saved unless Christ chooses to do so. The Israelites weren't cheering on the other side of the Red Sea saying, drown those Egyptians, stop those Egyptians. That was completely in the hands of God. And is there a risk doing this? Absolutely. But the guys who are at risk are probably mostly the ministers. If there's a risk. But they don't call it a walk of faith for nothing. But
yeah, I'm not afraid of taking the risk. I'm afraid of trying to defend a trust in court.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to do that unless you're a member of the order.
I would say that if I was elected a minister, that would make me a trustee, according to your words.
Well, that would be a trustee. If you were elected a minister, you would be a trustee, but most of the trustees are...
I don't want to be a trustee.
Well, then that's fine.
Because see, what's going to happen is you said that you had a judge tell you weren't they didn't have jurisdiction before. But if a court decides that they have jurisdiction over the trust, then they're going to have jurisdiction over the trustee.
Well, if they decide it, that make it so. The Pharaoh who was coming down on the Israelites
rather not have that word trust there at all and say it's a church in the ministry? Why call it a trust? You haven't given a good reason why to call it a trust.
Well, I have given a good reason. And I agree with you on a lot of the documents. It doesn't necessarily say trust. But trust is a word that goes way back, wasn't statutory, actually trust. Is like a Scottish word, even betrothal, getting married. That's a troth, a trust. A woman is going to trust her husband, and she brings something to the marriage. Again, we explain all this over and over again and emphasize it, and I've taken it to some top legal minds in the United States, and they were blown away because they see, I won't go into all the explanation because it's a recorded call, but, you know, and I don't require anybody to see it, but I am explaining it, that, and we don't always call it a sacred purpose trust, but if you say ministry, how many people understand what that means? How many churches out there say they have a ministry, but they don't provide any welfare? They don't rightly divide bread from house to house in any significant way whatsoever, like the early church was. But they call it a ministry. They say they have a worship service, and they all sit around and sing and praise, but they don't do a single thing to set their neighbor free. They say they care about their neighbor, they love their neighbor, but they don't have any charity, any real essence of charity. The early church took care of 100% of all the social welfare of Christians in the first century, second century, third century. And then along came another church that started receiving the equivalent of billions of dollars from a mass murderer. And they started redistributing that. And they said they were the church. And they've been doing similar things ever since. So where's the real church? Well, I'm showing you what the real church would look like based on what Christ said, which is why there are, I don't know how many footnotes I would, somebody can look in the back of the Free Church Report. There's probably 600 footnotes in there, maybe more. And, a lot of that is on a study where I've actually linked words and phrases to other articles that, so literally if I put down all the information in one book that the Free Church Report is referring to, it would be a 600-700 page book. But we make you go look up, you have to go look up the statutes, the laws, the rulings of courts, that the church is supposed to be separate. But what makes it separate? What makes it holy? Because holy means separate. It means that they can't be members of the social welfare system of Caesar. They can't be members of the social welfare system of Herod and the Pharisees. And we explain in great detail that that's why the Corban of the Pharisees was making the word of God to none effect. If you want your prayers to be of an effect, don't just tell me you believe in Jesus. Start doing what Jesus said. And what he was basically saying is that we have to care about one another as much as we care about ourselves. Go read our article, Care. The governments of the world have been trying to get you not to care about your neighbor, but to care about your government. Give the power to your government to care for your neighbor. It's not your responsibility anymore. Of course, what that leads to is that people are mobbed in the streets and raped in the streets, and nobody does anything. People drive by and seeing some girl being raped to death, and they don't do anything.
And hey, Mr. Williams.
Sure.
What do you think about the Christmas songs, how they kind of subverted them with like Frosty and Santa Claus and stuff?
Wow.
There used to be all like Christ is King and used to be songs about Jesus, but now they kind of subverted them.
Well, I want to
just quickly before you answer that, Gregory, because that'll probably take us to another subject. But I just wanted to address Acoustic's concern of, I think what he's getting at is to try and avoid the appearance of evil by using this term trust, because it has a connotation and a definition that, you know, is understood in a certain way. What we need to understand, Acoustic, is that we are prepared for that. We are prepared to educate and define the definition as we're using it, in a court of law if necessary.
That's not what I'm hearing here, and I appreciate that, but to better describe it, a trust is a creature of equity. It doesn't have a parent, it's not like it, it's not similar, it is. and it's not a product of the common law. One of the Brother Gregory is talking about 1066. One of the reasons why they created trust was to pass along property to illegitimate heirs. That's one of the purposes that they created the trust and equity to, was to get around God's law of inheritance.
Well, any father can give his inheritance to somebody else. And that goes way back even before Rome.
This is a penalty from God, he can't.
No, no, Seth.
You give the greater portion to your firstborn.
No, you don't have to.
Yes.
No, no.
Says who?
It's in the Bible. Shem.
Well, Isaac gave it to Jacob. He wasn't the firstborn.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, you go to Tamara, the same thing there.
He was tricked into believing he was giving it to his firstborn.
Yet still, God called him Israel.
No, God gave it to him through that process. Do you understand? Because Esau gave up the birthright because he didn't care. So God gave it to Israel, to Jacob, and that is not the firstborn.
Yeah,
I understand that, but still, the purpose of a trust is to break those laws,
Not necessarily. The purposes of the trust are defined by the prima facie evidence of the trust, the testimony of people, whether written or spoken. We do both. And the reality is that Abraham received the right of Shem, by the blessing of Shem, and Abraham was not the firstborn of Shem. He was the firstborn of Terah, but he didn't follow the ways of Terah. He separated from the ways of Terah, and he followed the ways of Melchizedek, and Melchizedek came and blessed Abram and made him Abraham. And so God is always making these exceptions. Always making these exceptions. Because you can become a son of God by adoption. Yes, there are certain rules that he lays down, but he can navigate. I mean, when Moses came and said, "Let my people go," he's saying my people, not my Israelite people, my Jewish relatives. He wasn't even, wouldn't even been the owner of all the Israelites. Except for the fact that he was the daughter of the son of Pharaoh. He was the son of the daughter of Pharaoh, but by adoption. Not by blood. And yet, he was the rightful heir of all of Egypt. The other guy was not. You go read our article on who was the Pharaoh at that particular time. He had no bloodline relationship with the former Pharaoh. The only one who had a right, he had it by adoption, and that's Moses. And Moses wasn't the firstborn of the family either. So, I mean, there was Aaron and their sister, although their sister was female, but still, normally the firstborn becomes the priest of the family. But eventually he has his own family. And it doesn't have to be him. Somebody else in the family can take that position for a variety of reasons. And like Mark said, we see that with Esau and Jacob. Now, Jacob used a certain amount of subterfuge, but he did what his mother told him. Jesus often did what his mother told him, even though he told her that it wasn't his time yet, but he still did what she told him. So that's part of the law too. But the reality is because he did it that way, he had to go into bondage for almost 20 years because of circumstances, and he didn't get anything from his father. He was on foot when he arrived with Laban. But the reality is that he eventually made God his father, and God blessed him accordingly, even to the point when he repented of all those things that he was doing wrong, which we just explained in those last studies concerning Jacob and Israel, is that that he became known as Israel because he started doing things the way he was supposed to do it. And Jesus has a parable about this. Two sons, he doesn't say which one is older. One says he's going to do what the father says, but he doesn't. And the other one says he's not going to do it, but then he changes his mind and does. Who is the real son? It's the son who doeth. And Jacob started doing, so he became that heir. And Esau went off and created dukes and kings. And but the sons of Jacob didn't listen to the ways of Jacob and Abraham. They were doing contrary to those ways. And so they had to go into bondage for 400 years. So we're in bondage today. And this kind of culminates the whole thing of what I was saying. Because we haven't been doing things like Jacob learned. We're more concerned about our own liberty than the liberty of our neighbor. Christ did not come to set himself free. He came so that others might be saved. Others might be free. Others might know what it means to be under the authority of Christ. And yeah, they might argue these things. And we've struggled with this word trust, and we have it in certain strategic places. You'll see that it's not capitalized. Some of the trusts are friends of his church at some location, but that's a trust, but you'll see the word trust there. You just see church. But we also know, I can't explain every little aspect of this, but this is the basic outline. Now, somebody asked, Duncan asked another question, and now, because I went off on that tangent, he was asking Christmas songs. Okay. I haven't celebrated Christmas since I was 9 years old, and I went into the seminary known as the Bah Humbug Kid when I was 13. Went through, all my years in school, being known as the Bah Humbug Kid, never celebrated Christmas. But I always did it lightheartedly and it got away with it, and everybody thought it was funny, kind of. But it was because when I was a kid, everybody talked about Christmas being too commercialized, and we're talking 65 years ago, and yet they all go out and commercialize it. So, but I can enjoy music. I don't care if it's Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer or whatever. And I let them have that holiday. I don't celebrate that holiday. I don't believe that giving should be seasonal. And I don't condemn anybody who wants to celebrate Christmas. There's a lot of rumors. What I'm trying to focus on is that you actually, the way you celebrate Christ is you start doing what Christ said. And, We don't put up a Christmas tree in the house. We haven't done that. It's amazing. People see you don't have a Christmas tree and they will bring one over. And, you know, and I can quote all the comments. And I do it lightheartedly. And people accept it. They know where I stand on it. It says that I want you to be real Christians, not holiday Christians. And so, anyway, that's my position on it. And yeah, they do all that, but, you know, we're into what Christ actually said to do. And I don't mind if people sing. They did mention people singing a little bit in the Bible, but church service is not singing and creating an emotional feeling. Service is actual service. Love. You can't love people from the pew. You have to get up and actually do things. And Christ said it, although a lot of people say there's nothing you have to do, but Christ said it's not those who say, Lord, Lord, but those who do it the will of the Father. And I assume that that also means not those who sing, Lord, Lord, either, but those who actually do it the will of the Father. But I tell you this, talking about singing, because I just wrote this in an article that's going to come up next week in the show. Because it talks about, and Amos 5 talks about people who know the song of Moloch. We need to learn the song of Moses and song of the Lamb. And what that was people sacrificing their own blood, sweat, and tears for the benefit of other people, those they know and those they don't even know. And that's why early Israel and the early church were organized in the tens, hundreds, and thousands, because you don't know everybody. You know the people that might be in your 10-family congregation. You might know people in quite a few other congregations. Maybe you know 100 people, but you don't know tens of thousands. But you have to care about those tens of thousands just as much. And the only way to actually physically care for them is to create a system of free will offerings through men you look at amongst yourself and you what? You trust them. Now, that trust may disappear if they don't do a good job. And because the kingdom of God is not based on contracts, covenants, and constitutions, if you don't trust a minister, don't ever give to him again. But find somebody else you can trust. And test him. You know, trust, but verify. And so, those who listen to all the different things, we're going to be talking about this in Leviticus more and more, that because that they have whole chapters on meat offerings and grain offerings and heave offerings, and we talked a little bit about that. What the heck is all that about? Well, it's about this concept of entrusting a second party with something that you owned for the purpose of another party. And that's the basic elements of a trust. And it even has the word trusting somebody else. It's not a, you don't have a contract with your minister. I will give you this $100 if you only give it to people who have blue eyes. Or whatever you want to put as the terms of the contract. No, you have to let it go. And,
and just a quick point there, Gregory. Sure. Because, you know, we're told, oh, you know, trust no man, and we understand what that means, but you don't have to trust the minister with, you know, like your newborn baby, or, you know, even with your wife necessarily, or whatever, but you just have to trust them enough. Trust them enough with what you're willing to give, and, like you said, if they abuse that trust, then you don't do it again. But you just have to trust enough.
Yeah, ultimately, you know, I've told this to ministers when they receive something, and they just, we saw that in Leviticus, he puts his hand on the thing that was given him. That's a huge responsibility once you see how it's written, because what you're saying, he doesn't own what you give him. You just gave him stuff that belongs to Christ. If he abuses that, he's answerable to who? To you? No. I mean, you can certainly stop giving to him. That's your responsibility. But he's answerable to Christ. You don't want to be that. And I've told that story. I won't tell it again. It's back there somewhere in the archives of somebody who owed me funds for work I did. And I said, you got 30 days to pay. If you don't pay me, I will cancel it. You won't owe me anymore, but you're going to owe Christ. Because he already knew I work for Christ. I only came and helped him. I haven't been an employee for 50 years, for anybody. And, when people come and ask me for help, I help them. And they ask me, what do they owe me? I says, well, these are the hours I work. I would consider those at this value, but you pay me what you want to give me. And there's only been a couple of people who didn't pay me the full amount, but they're all dead now. So anyway, but I didn't kill them.
And here's another point just on that one, Gregory. You know, the gentleman, Acoustic, has some, fairly valid concerns there.
Oh, yes. I get it. You know, we struggled with that word for a long time, and we've written a lot of stuff in documentation, verified it, witnessed it, to explain the difference between a sacred purpose trust and a statutory trust. All trusts have a purpose, and you have to spell that out. Like I said, when you mail a letter, you create a trust.
Yeah, but just on the point that you were talking about before I forget, Like you said before, with communism or Babylon, let's say, men are set against each other, and they're in violation of one another's property rights, right? And so the sacred purpose that we're talking about is loving God and loving your neighbor. That's the purpose.
Yeah. Right? All the commandments.
And so what Christ created there is the antithesis to Babylon. And if the world wants to come against that, ultimately it is God that will have to defend us. That's the faith that we have.
Absolutely.
We're not looking to finagle and to skirt and to, you know, wrangle and to, you know, get entangled with magistrates. But if they do come against us, it will be, and even if they jail or kill us, they will be accountable to God. And that's the point.
Right. There's two other offices. Let me mention them. Maybe it'll spawn another question. There's two other offices common in trust long before the statutes of the United States or even equity existed. Although equity is part of the United States way back to the Judiciary Act of 1789, Section 19 provides for equity. It's part of the law of the United States. And once you become a citizen of the United States, you're now could be subject to equity, but it's mostly what you do that brings you into that subjection. But the two other elements that you find referenced in relationship to this common natural law idea of entrusting somebody else with something you want to go to a third party, which exists at common law, and they called it trust, etc. But is an overseer and a protector. Well, the overseer of what we create has to be an ordained minister under a vow of poverty that is not of the world, and you have to have a record that proves that, and he has to be, you know, from our point of view, he has to be a minister of Christ. The world doesn't care whether he's a minister of Christ, just those other elements. And he can be the overseer. And that's very important, because if you don't have some sort of remedy for disputes within that possession where you gave your sheep to this guy to give to a third party, then it's not sufficiently something they can recognize. They only will recognize jurisdiction if the overseer is one of their people, or if the beneficiary is one of their people.
It's like God is waiting for us to take that responsibility, and until then, the world will assume that as a responsibility.
But ultimately, let me talk about that last character, the protector. The overseer is not really the protector. He may be a representative protector, in a sense, because he's overseeing. He doesn't really have any power. He can't regulate the minister. His power is in recognition or unrecognizing. And then he can facilitate changes that people allow him to do. But the protector is ultimately the Holy Spirit. That is our comforter. Now, a lot of people say, well, that ain't much. Well, in your mind, it's not. But in my life, I've seen it powerfully work. And, of course, that's what we see when Israelites left Egypt. When I first wrote Covenants of the Gods, everybody was asking if that worked. And I've said this 100 times. And I thought it was a strange question, because I just want to know how the world works. There's no remedy in the book. It even says so at the beginning of the book. I'm just showing you how you got into the problem. The remedies are found elsewhere in the other books we've written. But ultimately, the remedy is found in your own heart. But what this works to do is to get you down on the shores of the Red Sea, with all the armies of the Pharaoh and the worlds coming down on you with everything they got, with the intent to destroy you, and nothing standing between you and them but the power of God. You know, people are always looking for some remedy, like you were saying, Mark, you know, some sort of trick or some sort of legal leverage, and that we work, you know, we create our own freedom because of a really clever legally and all this stuff. Well, Christ was one of the cleverest legal minds I have ever seen. I've seen an awful lot of them. But it's the power of the Holy Spirit that makes it work, which is also Christ, God, and the Holy Spirit. That's all one thing, you know. People try to divide it up and all this kind of stuff, but it's all the same kettle. And so anyway, yeah, so I'm just showing you that if we don't start trying to take care of one another in a national way, we're not going to find the kingdom of God.
And just quickly, Gregory, nothing we're doing is illegal. That's the point.
Oh, absolutely.
People assume that if you're trying to, you know, get out of Babylon or, you know, whatever, leave the system, that, oh, you must be doing something illegal. That's the whole thing.
Well,
the case was adjudicated at Pontius Pilate and Jesus.
Yeah, if I had no guilt in this matter. even Festus and Agrippa. Even Festus and Agrippa found Paul innocent. When you were talking there, I had this one thought, and it's escaping me, but, you said it's legal. It's more than legal. It's lawful. Well, of course, I'm being semantically more correct, because, it's also reasonable. It's the logos of Christ. Logos meaning right reason. And when they say the word of God, it's the right reason of God. And is it not lawful to do with mine own what I will? And you have the right today in America and in most countries. I don't know about China. I haven't examined them. I think their rights are as wispy as the wind in the water. But in most countries, Australia, England, Canada, you have a right to practice freedom of religion. And religion is how you fulfill your duty to God and your fellow man. That's the definition of religion. We cover that in all of our paperwork and all of our books and all of our articles. So that's setting the evidence that is all admissible in a court, that's what we're doing. Is that we're trying to fulfill our duty to God and our fellow man without shirking any of the duties that we might have established through our parents or through our actions earlier in our life. And so that's what we're trying to do. If we owe Caesar, we want to pay Caesar. But if you read the Free Church Report and you read the footnotes, when I originally brought that book to Washington, D.C., it was like, I can't remember now, probably I'd already reduced it down, but it was still about 40 pages longer than it is now. But I reduced it down to 144 pages. But I did that with footnotes. If you look up the footnotes, you can go online and find out what I'm referring to. Because those footnotes are actual documented laws in the United States that they didn't put there because Congress loves me or loves liberty. It's there for another reason. And I can go into that whole explanation, but I'll save that for the festivals. I'm not going to put all that on the air. But the reality is that this is well thought out, but you don't have to believe me. Don't have to take my word for it. This is why all the books are free. You can download all the books free online. All the articles are free. Nobody has to, you don't have to give me your credit card or your firstborn. I was saying before to Justin that, most of the trustees that are in the network are operating what we call ex officio. So you can look up the word ex officio, in which is Latin, in the Free Church Report. You can look it up at Preparing You. And they're not under vows of poverty. And they're trustees. And unless they start taking donations and going to resorts with the money, that is clearly not the purpose, or, you know, hiring prostitutes and the things that we saw with Black Lives Matter was doing, they won't get into trouble. As a matter of fact, everything is designed to keep them from not getting into trouble. All the records show, if they keep the records like they're supposed to, it shows that, yeah, okay, that they receive this money. We don't want them putting the money in their personal accounts or anything like that, if it's money or even stuff. But, and we have overseers trying to make sure that they don't do anything that will get them into trouble. And so anyway, but it's still their choice. I'm not making anybody do anything. That's the other government that does that. This is a voluntary society based on freedom of religion, free will offerings, sacrificed to take care of the needy of society. And you're going to see more and more need of that. Right now we've got a little bit of a respite. If we had a different president in charge, not that the president in charge now is saving us or anything, but if we had some of the other candidates that were running in charge, the borders would still be wide open. You wouldn't hear anything about Somalians or USAID or Doge. None of those things would be taking place. Now, I don't think any of those things, the fact that we're learning any of those things, are actually going to save anybody. But it's information that you would not have seen otherwise. But all it is showing you is that what you've been doing for the last 100 years, maybe even 200 years, is a corrupting influence. If you develop an appetite for benefits and the habit of receiving them by the rule of force, because you're content with living at the expense of others and depending for your livelihood on the property of others, you're going to find once more a monarch and a king, and all your neighbors are going to become perfect savages. And when things get hard, they will be killing you, robbing you, and stealing from you because they don't love you. So, and everybody won't love you. But if the way you find people who really love you is you start loving other people, which means that you get to speak your mind to other people. There's freedom of speech in the kingdom of God. But finding men you trust, that's a job. And find men that are worthy of trust, that requires a certain amount of strain. You know, it's like I used to have to haul cabinets into houses, and you had to carry them with other people. It was like a dance, you know, big long 12-foot cabinets, hauling them into houses and upstairs and stuff like that. You had to develop trust with that other guy or guys. And you didn't do that by reading about it. You could only do that by doing it. And it's with everything else. You know, if you're going to row boats or whatever, you gotta work as a team. And that's where you start deciding who you can trust and who you can't trust. Ultimately, I want you to be following the Holy Spirit to tell you those things. But Christ said, not those who say, but those who do it. We're just showing you one way to create a system of social welfare or social safety net that can help you in hard times, which we see the first century church doing, without depending upon the fathers of the earth or the men who exercise authority one over the other. We believe that there will be a secondary blessing, that as you hear the cries of your neighbor, God will hear your cries and your prayers will have a greater influence. But that will be up to God. But it's also up to you to follow the way. And that's what we're talking about. But anyway, any other questions? We've got our 2 hours in. I'm looking at some of the people in there. I see
no,
a few.
Not really a question. Okay. Just a little bit of a just a bit of a comment. You know, you said that the people in the world, they don't care about each other. And, you know, Christ said to love one another. And so we have a situation where people, by virtue of the policy of the system, are a transgressing, they're in a transgression against their neighbour, like I said before, because they, by policy, are in violation of their property rights by forcing their neighbour to contribute to their welfare. So they're actually, they're oblivious to this transgression. They actually are self-righteous. They don't know they're in a transgression necessarily. And because they're in the transgression, their emotions have to follow the deed. And that's why they are apathetic to their neighbour. So that's why they don't care about their neighbour emotionally, because they don't care about them indeed. And on top of not caring about them now emotionally, they have to pretend to care about them. So yeah. That's what we're seeing. We're seeing a bunch of people pretending to care about one another, especially sometimes the further left you go, they even have, on top of the pretentiousness, they even signal the virtue even more. You know, you see everybody hugging one another and kissing one another, pretending to care, where indeed they don't. And it's just, you know, the meaning of Babylon.
Right. And Jesus said that.
They're not in true communication.
Yeah, Jesus said, when he talks about, if you just love one another, even thieves and robbers do that. And of course, I mean, nobody, you know, I mean, the first time I saw guys like, you know, in a movie where the guys were kissing, there was no gay thing in it. It was mafia guys kissing other mafia guys on the cheek. So yeah, they hug and love one another, but boy, you might end up in a cement overshoe somewhere if you cross them. But the reality is people are under strong delusion, and I don't know who out there in the world will suddenly wake up. I am not the source of them waking up. I am just sharing what God has shared with me. If they wake up, they're going to wake up by the grace of God, and they're going to see it. And it's going to be uncomfortable at times, but they're under a strong delusion. And you know, Mark's been around long enough. All the different articles that come up, from the red heifer to, you know, altars of clay and stone and all these things. It is so shattering of so many aspects of the delusion. You know, I really should publish that argument I had with Grok on what did they use as a social welfare system in the Old Testament. And he had no idea, Grok, like I said, I don't want to gender him, had no idea that the altars were a part of a social welfare system. But I was just showing back quotes to him, and suddenly Grok said, oh my gosh, and he outlined the whole thing. You know, but it's Grok. But I thought it was an interesting experiment. But we had somebody, my daughter knows somebody who was hearing a news thing. They don't live in this valley, but he comes around once in a while and helps out. He's really a nice guy and everything. But I don't think he's paid income tax probably in 20 years. And, you know, he lives in a tent, and he's pretty self-sufficient. He probably doesn't make enough to file or anything. He finally got a bank account, I think, just within the last year. He was hearing about people, you know, giving all these illegal immigrants welfare, which used to be absolutely against the law and not done. And he says, well, that's pretty fair. They give them a little bit to help them out. I mean, why can't we do that? And my daughter pointed out and says, you're very generous with other people's money because you haven't paid into the system for 20 years. And I think if people want to give money to illegal immigrants, I've helped the illegal immigrants out all the time. I used to work on an onion radish farm where half the employees were from Mexico. I don't know what their status was, but I know when the immigration officers showed up, a lot of people were running in different directions. But, you know, I was fine working with them, but none of them were on welfare. They were actually working. And they were assets, and they were pretty moral people. I'm okay with that. But I wasn't hiring them. I was just working alongside of them, just like everybody else. It was early in my youth, and it was an experience, and I learned a lot from it. I even know a few Spanish words. The Spanish people pick the radishes, and the Filipinos pick the onions. But I learned a lot from that experience that is actually comes out in our, my books. But yeah, if you want to give money to them, go find one and give them to them. But don't think you're generous because you're giving other people's money to them. Because that's absolutely the antithesis of Christ and Moses and Abraham. But anyway, anything else? Okay. Well, we've used up our 2 hours, and I thank everybody for coming. There's so much more to this. If people, like I said, there's links now to the Sacred Purpose Trust page that covers a lot of these things. We talked about how you can get the free church report. Probably the most important thing is to start having these conversations with other people who have been studying it too and learn together. But the most important thing is to actually do what Christ said. And we recommend you join the network by going to preparingyou.com, click on the network links, and join the network in your area. And anyway, so basically that covers it. Thanks, everybody, for coming. God bless.
God bless you, everyone.
For more information, go to hisholychurch.org or preparingyou.com. Join the network. Listen to the audios at most podcast providers under Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. Thanks, everyone, and God bless. Make sure you follow us at His Holy Church on X.